Last Sunday, I took a lighthearted jab, it was meant to be lighthearted anyway, at an outfit called the Freedom From Religion Foundation, who have launched an ad campaign to supposedly debunk the Christmas story. Picked it up in a New York Times piece about it. One of their ads shows a nativity scene, as I pointed out last week, with the heading, "You know it's a myth, this season celebrate reason." Well, I played off that ad to get in my own reasonable opinion that a myth, rightly understood, is hardly a bad thing. And this ad also reminded me of a parody. One of our retired Unitarian Universalist ministers, the Reverend Chris Rabel, once composed, playing off of the hymn, "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen." It's also a lighthearted jab at our UU penchant for reason. And it occurred to me that I could probably help out those Freedom From Religion people by offering this hymn that Chris Rabel wrote for them to use in their campaign. So I'm going to read it for you. Jed is going to play "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen." This is the closest you'll ever come to hear me singing something, which ain't close at all. Let me tell you, I'm just going to read this. All right. God rest you, Unitarians. Let nothing you dismay. Remember, there's no evidence there was a Christmas day. When Christ was born, it's just not known, no matter what they say. Good tidings of reason and fact. Reason and fact. Good tidings of reason and fact. There was no star of Bethlehem. There was no angel song. There could have been no wise men, for the journey was too long. The stories in the Bible are historically wrong. Good tidings of reason and fact. Reason and fact. Good tidings of reason and fact. Most of our Christmas customs come from Persia and from Greece, from solstice celebrations of the ancient Middle East. We all know this so-called holiday is but a pagan feast. Good tidings of reason and fact. Reason and fact. Good tidings of reason and fact. Thank you, Jen. Okay, well, there's my contribution to celebrating reason. All right. I like Chris Rabel's playfulness here, and that's what it is. At the same time, what he is saying, everything I read there is factually correct, pretty much word for word. Chris is also being playful in order to make what I think is a quite valid point. The reason and fact alone are a pretty thin stew when it comes to experiencing any kind of good tidings in a season that celebrates joy and hope and peace and love. These are the four themes, as noted last Sunday, of the Advent season. As I also pointed out, one certainly need not be a Christian to need and desire these four things, both in our personal lives and in the larger world in which we live. But expressions of good tidings, in fact, are more likely to be found in the realms of mythology and mystery and fantasy than sometimes found in the worlds of reason and fact. And that realm of myth and fantasy, I know, is one that we religious liberals have some problems with from time to time. We have some mixed feelings about it. One of the more oft-cited reasons that I hear as to why people come and join a congregation like this one is they say, "I want to get away from all that mythology I'm supposed to believe in. I like to come to a church where I don't have to check my brains at the door." And I appreciate that. It's one of several reasons that I became a UU myself and entered the UU ministry. One of the things that does draw many of our members and friends into this congregation is a desire to escape mythology that is offered as fact or offered as the basis for dogma or doctrine. And I'm glad we can provide a haven for such folks in that regard. However, you know there's another side to this thing. While we don't check our brains at the door, we bring more than just our brains through the door. If I were only standing here speaking to an assemblage of brains, if nothing else, that would look a little weird. Probably more like a scene out of a science fiction movie than that of a gathered congregation. No, the truth is, we bring our whole selves. We bring our whole lives here. Our feeling selves, our wondering selves, our selves that are in need of tidings of comfort and joy and hope and healing. And I happen to believe there is a place, an important and valued place in our liberal religious community for stories and legends and mythology which offers such good tidings. And I also know this is not, for those of you who've been around here for some time and listening to me hold forth from, Lord, 22 years now, it's not a new topic for me. It's one I like to revisit, though, especially at this time of year. This, then, is the second installment of my Christmas and winter holiday sermons for this December. Last Sunday, I spoke about how an insistence on a prescribed belief system actually stifles what I call the religious impulse, the universal human impulse, that is to say, to look beyond ourselves for some greater meaning to our lives and some greater sense of connection to a vast and mysterious universe in which we all live, move, and have our being. And I ended up that sermon last Sunday by noting that one way human beings have responded to this impulse over the course of human history has been to tell stories, myths, and legends. So I'm picking up on that mythology thread for today. Mythology is indeed powerful stuff. And like a lot of powerful stuff, it needs to be handled with care. Right about the time I began my ministry here, which was in the late 1980s, there was a hugely popular television series that ran on the public broadcasting system. Maybe some of you caught it, and it became something of a cultural phenomenon as people watched it. It was a series of mostly just sit-down conversations between two individuals, namely journalist Bill Moyers and the now late Dr. Joseph Campbell, and it was called The Power of Myth. I think it's still available. You can, you know, get the CD or DVD or whatever at the library and take it and watch it. Dr. Campbell, up until this series ran, had spent most of his life quietly in academia, a lot of that as a professor of religious studies and mythology at New York's Sarah Lawrence College. He died not too long after the series first aired, which still left enough time for him to become something of a folk hero and close out his life with a certain amount of flair. Thanks to Bill Moyers, Campbell did get his Warholian 15 minutes of fame. It was actually more like about 15 hours, which was the approximate length of the whole series. So I'm going to run with Campbell here the next few minutes. For his contention was that myths, whatever the particular religious or cultural setting in which they are told, are metaphors about human life and human experience. On the surface, they supposedly describe an external and quite fantastical type of events. The creation of the world by God or gods. A birth, virgin or otherwise, that comes from the union of earthly and divine parents. A death followed by a resurrection. A hero or a heroine who becomes the savior of humanity. These are common themes, these are common stories in many of the world's religious traditions, both past and present. And according to Campbell, these are really stories about something going on within us, in here, right now, rather than in some fanciful past. As Campbell put it, myths are stories of our search through the ages for meaning, for significance. We all need help in our passages from birth to life and then to death. Myths are clues to the spiritual potentialities of life. All right, Campbell was, in addition to being a professor of religious studies, he was also a student. I think he wrote a couple of books about Carl Jung. He was a student and interpreter of Dr. Carl Jung. He was one of the early pioneers in the field of psychology, founder of a field of psychology called, well, Jungian psychology. And it was from Jung that Campbell got the idea that the deepest or most ultimate origins of mythology are in what Carl Jung called the collective unconscious. Now, some of you may have picked this up in a psych class somewhere. It's fairly basic, but we'll take a quick trip around the block with it. According to Jung, we exist in three levels of consciousness. We each have our conscious level, first of all, which is what we're aware of, what we're thinking about in our waking moments. Each and all of you, I'm going to assume right now, are operating on your conscious level, you know, unless you're asleep. Or, you know, in some kind of a deep daydream or something like that, then you're somewhere else. That's okay, you know, just stay there, enjoy. We'll be done before too much longer. But, okay, conscious level is pretty much where, you know, you spend your waking hours. Below your waking consciousness, to use a little spatial imagery, is your personal unconscious. And this is where you store all your personal memories, your experiences, your desires, fears, hopes, urges, compulsions, all of that kind of thing. Some of that personal unconscious you dip into frequently, and some of it you may not want to get too near at all. Most post-traumatic stress, whether it is from the battlefield or from episodes of abuse or whatever other sources, comes ultimately from what has been stored in one's personal unconscious and needs to be freed in some way in order that you can live a little better on your conscious level. Now, some of you may remember, it's been out of print for some time, a long discontinued comic strip called Outland. Remember a comic strip, very funny, bizarre little comic strip called Outland. And one of the characters in this strip was a fellow called Binkley. And Binkley had this closet in his room that he was always afraid to open up because of all the weird and crazy stuff that came flying out of it every time he did. Now, I know it's just a comic strip, but Binkley's closet really was his personal unconscious. Personal unconscious is the place, then, where we store all of our personal stuff. And I just mentioned some of that stuff is pleasant. Some of it's a joy to bring back to consciousness. A lot of it is just mundane. And some of it can be frightful and scary and traumatic. All of that, personal unconscious. Okay, but wait, there's more. According to Jung and Campbell, there's one more step we take down to what Jung called the collective unconscious. This is kind of like the Binkley's closet for the whole human race. It's our common closet, as it were, where all the collective stuff of humanity resides. Now, Carl Jung's father was a Lutheran minister. This was the home setting in which Jung was raised before pursuing a career in the very new field at that time of psychology. And Jung came to notice that when some of his clients would begin describing their dreams to him, they were invoking common symbols and themes and motifs in them, ones that he noticed parallels with from one client to another. And Jung further came to notice that some of these themes and symbols and motifs were also found in one expression or another, in one way or another, in the stories and the myths of the various religions, including the faith in which he was raised and inculcated. So Jung concluded that dreams and mythologies are ultimately rooted in this common closet of humankind. Now, the content of myths, as already noted, will vary from one culture to another, but some of the same fundamental motifs, dealing with the mysteries of birth and life and death, certain forms of rebirth and renewal, all the things that we in a human race, as a human race, experience, celebrate, hope for, fear, all of those things are common to them. So myths, then, Jung and Campbell came to conclude, draw from this common pool of human memory and thought. They tell us about who we are, about how we find meaning, about our deepest hopes and longings and fears. So myths are only lies, then, when they're offered as facts. To treat them uniformly as lies is, in Dr. Campbell's words, to get stuck in the metaphor, rather than looking past the metaphor and allowing it to speak to your relationship to yourself, to all the rest of life, to letting it touch you some realm, to letting it touch you in some realm beyond the realm of reason and fact. Another metaphor example Campbell used for that was, he said, if your finger is pointing towards the moon, you focus on what the finger is pointing to and not get worried about how much truth or whatever there is in the finger itself. As I irony here, as I noted last week, is that the two types of persons most likely and most susceptible to getting trapped or stuck in the metaphor are fundamentalists and hardcore secular humanists. Fundamentalists because they have a need for a myth to be, in their mind, factually correct in order to take any meaning from it, and secularists who dismiss myths as lies because they have little, if any, factual base, which is precisely what the Freedom From Religion Foundation people are doing. Try getting at it this way. See what I'm saying. When you stand in front of a painting done in any kind of style, you probably don't ask yourself, is this painting true or false? Or does this painting depict an event that actually happened? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But such questions miss the point of the artist's work. The relevant questions are, does this painting touch me? Does it pull me out of myself? Does it give me some sense of connection with the rest of life and the rest of being, of which I am but a small part? This is what mythology, as well as art and poetry and music and literature, all do at their best. They take us out of ourselves and give us some sense of connection to all that is, to all of being. And myths are also like poetry or art or music or literature, in that some type of each can move and inspire one greatly, while other types don't do much for other people. What catches one person, that is to say, when it comes to mythology, or art, or poetry, or music, does not catch another, which is why we need a wide variety of each and all. Well, in addition to holding up what I've had to say this morning, I'm also setting the table for some of what I'll be saying next week in this holiday and holy day season. Gotta hang in with one more Sunday to get to the end of this thing. For today, I'll just very quickly touch on some of what I am putting on that table when it comes to our being touched and hopefully instructed in some way when it comes to the often fanciful stories and legends and myths of this season. The myth or legend of the birth of Jesus does carry a message about the birth of hope in the midst of need and want and in rather desperate circumstances. According to Campbell, the virgin birth stories that are common to a number of faith traditions and mythological traditions are really about the human need for a spiritual awakening or regeneration at some point in our lives after our natural births have happened. They're not about anatomy. They're about our need for a fresh start at some point in our lives, a virgin birth in the midst of life. The gifts born by the mythological magi to the mythological child speak, I feel, to a deep-seated human need for generosity and sharing, and of a human desire to see at least some of the wealth of the world made available to those in most need of it, in order that we may truly be a human family. The legend of King Herod ordering the deaths of infants under a certain age, even with its dubious historicity, is really about some of the deep-seated fears that even the most powerful and the mighty have of anything they see, however seemingly meager, that poses a threat to their power and their might. Well, as I say, I'm going to focus on this story with its mix of history and legend and mythology next Sunday as a way of wrapping up this seasonal trilogy. As a way of closing for today, I'll offer a story from our own Unitarian Universalist lore. The story itself, as best I can determine, is historically true. But it's also about what can happen, what needs to happen, when we allow ourselves to be touched by certain things that exist somewhere beyond the realms of reason and fact. It's a story about the 19th century lyric poet and Unitarian Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. If you've ever visited or been to a worship service at the First Parish Unitarian Universalist Church of Portland, Maine, they still have the little door on the side, the Longfellow pew sitting there in their sanctuary where Henry and his family would sit. I've never been to a Sunday service there, so I don't know if they allow other people to sit in the Longfellow pew or not, but it still sits there. And this story takes place during the Civil War, when Longfellow was in a very low state of mind and spirit. Whether or not it was a clinical depression is hard to determine, but he was quite depressed. In 1861, his wife had died in a horribly tragic incident after being burned all over with a candle she had lit up to light up their home one evening, caught her clothes and her hair on fire. In trying to save her, Henry himself was so badly burned that he was unable to even attend his wife's funeral. And the reason you see most of the pictures of him, you see him with this big flowing beard, the reason you see those pictures like that with that full beard is because he grew it to cover up the scars on his face that fire which took his wife's life had left on him. He was scarred in more ways than one. And then on the heels of this personal tragedy came the Civil War. Longfellow was a fervent abolitionist, but he was hoping that the slavery issue, as well as the other matters that divided the North and the South, could be resolved in a peaceful and nonviolent way. The violence of the war disturbed him greatly, and this too became a personal concern when his son Charles went off to join the Union Army. Charles, as it turned out, was severely wounded in battle, sent home to his father, not knowing whether he would recover or die. It was as he nursed his son, who did in time recover, that Longfellow found himself dealing with his own crisis of faith. It was not only about whether he could continue to believe in the God in whom he'd been trusting, but whether there was any kind of hope for humanity to ever turn from its warring ways and seek the ways of peace. And so it was in the midst of his emotional and spiritual pain that he heard bells ringing announcing the arrival of Christmas Day in Portland, Maine. On the grounds of reason and fact alone, Longfellow had very little to hope for or be hopeful about. But the sound of the bells and his recollection of a story that promises peace on earth and goodwill to all reached him on some other level, on those levels I was speaking about earlier. So he did what practically any poet would do in that situation. He wrote a poem. And he wrote it from somewhere in his being that needed good tidings of something other than reason and fact. The language and the style of the poem that he wrote in that situation is that of mid-19th century New England lyric poetry. It also reflects mid-19th century Unitarian theology as well. But while written within the context of a particular religious faith, and at a particular point in time, it points to a universal longing that both encompasses and transcends the bounds of any one faith, any one time, any one place. And the things that drove Longfellow to despair have, sadly, unfortunately, not gone away. They continue to challenge us, challenge our faith stances today, whatever our faith may be, and however we give voice to it. Longfellow wrote of the reconciled world that all persons of faith yearn for and continue to work for. And if we are to keep on working for a more just and sane and peaceful world, we know at the same time we cannot turn our eyes and our ears away from the facts, the often painful facts of the world in which we live. But we also need to hear the stories, the fanciful stories, and the poetry and the music that will touch our souls and continue to give us hope and courage along the way. So with that in mind, let's sing together the words one of our spiritual ancestors penned over 150 years ago. It's number 240. The tune Jed plays is the more familiar one than the one used in our hymnal, but I think you'll recognize it very soon. Let's sing. Let's stand and sing that together.